Okay. Paper 118, section 2, which is old single column, page 1296. Okay. Remember, like I pointed out last time, you have a very obvious first set of three sections here that are tying to the paper title. You know, first you had time, now you have space, and then you have time and space. So they're obviously wanting you to be reflecting on that parallel that they set up in the title, like we mentioned last time. So here we are on a section where they're focusing a little bit more specifically on the spatial component. And just as a preface, let's make sure that we have the distinction between the two words in the title in mind before we start. In common usage in the English language, those words are usually just synonyms, both meaning everywhereness. And in that they do, but if you look at the etymology of them, there's a different flavor to the two. There's two different types of everywhereness. The prefix omni, as I think everyone knows, because it's so common to actually replace the omni with the prefix all. The omni means all. Okay, so it's an everywhere present in that sense, where you're talking about the whole thing all at once. There's an all that's being engaged. Okay. But ubiquity, the ubi is where, but the qua part of the word is any. Not all, but any. Okay. And that's the fundamental differential of the truth. The true meaning of these words as they're using them. Ubiquitous, if something is ubiquitous, it's everywhere, but in the sense of you can take any point, this one or that one or that one or that one, and it's there, whatever it is that you're talking about. So it's on the inside of the space you're talking about. You take any point in that space, and whatever it is that you're talking about is there. And it's at every point in that space. So it's everywhere in the sense of any. But the other is outside. It's fundamentally a transcendent relationship. The only way that you could relate to it as an all instead of a total any is if you're transcendent, so that you basically engage it, the whole domain, as if it was one point, as one all. Okay. So that's the distinction that's in play, a transcendent and a within everywhereness.
I'm sorry, what did you say that the UBI part meant?
That's where, the word where.
The word where.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's literally any awareness. Okay. All right. So let's see how they start out. And you notice there's a big break after this first paragraph because they seem to be liking this idea of let's put a whole bunch right in the first thing. And they do it again. So it'll take us a while to talk about that first paragraph. Go ahead.
Two, omnipresence and ubiquity. The ubiquity of deity must not be confused with the ultimacy of the divine omnipresence. It is volitional with the universal Father that the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute should compensate, coordinate, and unify his time-space ubiquity and his time-space transcended omnipresence with his timeless and spaceless universal and absolute presence. And you should remember that while deity ubiquity may be so often space associated, it is not necessarily time conditioned.
Okay. Now, it's a very interesting paragraph in the one sense that there's it's very much a very condensed summary. You kind of notice that how you have a series of thoughts stuck together in this one paragraph. So let's just start wading into it. Now, the first thing, they're obviously taking off from the title. You know, you see the ubiquity and the omnipresence there in that first sentence. Notice all the other differences in play. Ubiquity of deity, but, you know, omnipresent divinity, divine omnipresence. Okay, so that's the first thing that ought to catch your eye, because we've been working on getting a much more natural understanding going about the difference between divinity and deity. Okay, see, so notice that distinction that they're bringing into play there. And then the other thing that you see right there is must. Okay. Now, that should catch your attention. I mean, because especially since I gave you the full etymological, careful distinction thing as a preface, you know, is it a must because God is very particular about semantics? And if you get them wrong, you know, it's not looking good for you. I mean, okay, it can't be must because of that. So why does it say must? This distinction is vital. Okay? This is, you know, there's a whole bunch of things in this paragraph that are trying to point the, you know, the studier of the revelation towards God the Mother. Well, we've already, you know, got that in our quiver of understanding. And so you should see it right away. We've talked about this a lot. You know that the ubiquity of deity, that's, you know, that's the mother. You know, that's that womb-like, space-filling, you know, ubiquitous presence. Okay. But other things, you know, you'll use the omni prefix about, you know, like omnipresent. Yeah. Okay, so, you know what, I forgot to do it. Someone have my little chart? Yeah. Forgot to grab my copy. Okay, this is a good time to go back to this little table here. You know, if you don't have any, you know, they're on the back table there. Because we touched on this, and I didn't want to get into it too deep when it came up a few weeks ago. But let's look back at this in this context. When we have this hierarchical set of mothers, okay, remember how I mentioned that it's a very definitive thing experientially, that it's literally an experiential mother relationship to you. You know, as you move up through the first, second, third, fourth cosmic levels. But you, I don't know, do you remember that I mentioned that you need to keep this a little bit as a qualification in mind as you, when you go up above that? So much so that the box actually, I purposely put a gray box there at the top. Remember how we talked about they're on the fifth level, the infinite, where I wrote infinite mother spirit. You have that universal spirit mind presence of the third source and center. Okay, the third source and center is definitely transcendent of the finite. So that's an omnipresence. And, it's not deity that's spread out that we're immersed in. Yeah. It's divinity. See, it's a divine omnipresence. And the same way with the Eternal Mother Son. Both of that, that from our perspective, it's the deityness of the mother there in both of those, the second and third, is basically existential. And the divinity is experiential. But see, that's the distinction that we're trying to get at. So again, that universal spirit, now drop the mind. We're getting further and further away from sort of a mind womb sort of a situation. We go from a spirit mind presence. Now it's just a spirit presence, and you might even call it spirit gravity. When you get up to that sixth cosmic level and you're talking about the Eternal Mother Son. Okay. So this distinction that they're talking about here, that they're saying must about, is tied to this. It's at the supreme level there, the finite upholder, the universal mother. That is the high point for us as finite beings of literal ubiquity of deity, the mother. Okay. Beyond that, it's a divine omnipresence. Now, it is tied to the mother nature in those beings, but they're engaging us from a transcendent station. Okay. So that's the thing to keep in mind with this. Remember I mentioned at the same time, we don't have absonite upholder, absolute upholder. That's not in this picture because we're going to talk about that some tonight, going on beyond the finite upholder, the universal mother, the supreme as the mother. But in this context of a parallel to the sevenfold and what's directly engaging you and that stairway to heaven, as it were, you go from ubiquity to omnipresence as you move up this. And very rarefied to the point where, the infinite upholder, that's a root of mother-likeness. Obviously, the absolute, the absonite, and the finite upholder are related to the infinite upholder. But that's the point, that's technically the father when you get all the way to there. Hence the group being grayed out. But it also understands from that individual point of view that you take a fragment of that infinite upholder, the virgin adjuster, and you encase it in experiential mother-like character, which can happen because it's in this sequence here, in this vertical sequence, and that character can engage you. That mother-like character can engage you. So it serves in this cosmic mother hierarchy, but in a more and more sense of, you have to understand the context in which you're talking. There's an asterisk, needs to be next to it so that you don't make simplistic assumptions about it. But up to the finite upholder, it's very literal. It's what we're talking about here, ubiquity of deity, not just divinity, literally deity, immersed in a womb of deity. Okay? And it's a ubiquity, not that less direct, imminent like of ubiquity. See, because again, what is one of the distinctions here between the omnipresence and the ubiquity? We've been pointing this out. You have God as transcendence and God as immanence. God as immanence is fundamentally, God the mother is fundamentally ubiquity. God as transcendence, when that transcendent fact, whatever it is, the infinite spirit or whatever, if it has a relationship to you, it's an omnipresent relationship. It's not a ubiquitous relationship.
One of the things that seems to me is that there's all things absolute have been downstepped to the finite. And we're at the bottom of that. So the same thing here. Omnipresence is downstepped to ubiquity. But we can understand that both from, and you know, possibly the thought adjuster is involved in this, from the bottom up and from the top down. From the bottom up is what we're going to move through and touch a lot of those points, both physically and intellectually. But spiritually, if we can, you know, get that top-down view of omnipresence and attach that to God, whether it's the Father or whichever aspect of deity we're working with or divinity, then that helps us expand our concept of who God is, who the Father is, you know.
And even how you brought up, because you'll see that'll come up a little bit, let me just point that out, to help you appreciate a little bit different, a little bit more of the difference between mind and spirit. It's a much tighter relationship between the word mind and the word ubiquitous, and between spirit and omnipresent. I mean, don't think about that simplistically, but begin to sense that that there's a similar differential there. Okay, you know, it's first and foremost, you know, in terms of direct understanding, a mind womb that you're in. Okay? I mean, yeah, there's a spirit presence too, but it's you know, just because of that hierarchical nature of matter, mind, spirit, and your consciousness is in the mind, that spirit domain is always a measure transcendent, and hence its engagement to you is more of an omnipresence in your mind than a ubiquity. So see, there's a parallel there. all right. Now, the next thing here, it is volitional with the universal Father. Okay, before you read anything else, that should spark something. They want that to spark a thought. It's like, oh yeah, I remember how they've pointed out that, you know, he chose to self-distribute as much as possible. But if you're thinking in that context of, okay, here, you know, the Father has everything, and then he doles it out, even though technically that's a, you know, not quite the, you know, the way to think about it. But if you think about it in that simplified perspective, okay, so you take this sense. It is volitional with the universal Father that the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute should compensate, coordinate, and unify his time, space, okay, well, then, you know, those three, okay. Okay, just the way that's constructed there, that's the way we want you to understand it. He had these three attributes, those things I didn't read. you know, those three things were in the I Am, you know, in the totality, and they get doled out. They get delegated. Okay? And see, they're wanting you to think about this delegation step in a way that you haven't up to this point, except for now, because we've been talking so much about, you know, the other side of the original, the Mother and the Paradise Trinity. Compensate, coordinate, and unify. There's three words again. Can anyone guess what three words? Those might be, or three phrases. Remember the totality attitudes? The coordinate action. See, the one that the key is the word coordinate again in the middle. The second one has coordinate in it again. Totality attitudes, coordinate action, and cosmic over control. That was up there in the Trinity paper, remember? And that we were pointing out how that's tied to the Mother. That threefold functionality of the Trinity, not attributes, but functionality of the Trinity. Gives rise to the womb, the focalizer, and the upholder. Okay, you've got the same thing here again. I mean, that totality attitude compensates for all of the individuality attitudes that the Father's going to create. You're an absolutely unique personality. You're an absolutely unique personality. Something needs to compensate for the individuality attitude. There needs to be a totality attitude. And then, of course, the coordinate action is just right there directly again. And then that cosmic over-control, the unification, getting it all under one umbrella, all upheld as one. It's the three things again. So it's a little key. It's like, maybe I should go back and look at the Paradise Trinity paper again. And I wonder where in the paper. Well, let me just go to the beginning of the Paradise Trinity paper, and I read this sentence, the very first sentence of the Trinity paper. The Paradise Trinity, that's paper 10, it's just right, single column, page 108. It's just one sentence, so you can... The Paradise Trinity of eternal deities facilitates the Father's escape from personality absolutism. Okay? And remember when we talk about, this a lot, we're talking about it in the perspective when we're of the seven absolutes of infinity, especially the three persons, and they talk about that personality absolutism, getting the Son into existence and then the Spirit into existence, and now finally the Father has freed himself from the fetters of unqualified personality. They're bringing... that's obviously not the context that we're talking about here. We're talking about the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute. Okay, and just notice, see anew, what that sentence says. The Paradise Trinity facilitates the Father's escape. Remember how when we talk about this universal Father and the eternal Son, that technically you don't have a universal Father until you have an eternal Son for there to be a Father? Mm-hmm. Okay. Look around on the other side of the original, okay? You also don't have a father until you have a mother. You don't have a mother until you have a father, okay? You know that the mother is coming directly from the Trinity, okay? And this is tied to recognizing very clearly now that when we're talking about the seven absolutes of infinity, and we start that story of the Father and the Son and the Spirit. Those are individualities. That's an individuality viewpoint. And then the Trinity is a consequence. It's an afterthought. The one gives rise to the second, and the two together gives rise to the third, and the three together give rise to the fourth, to the Paradise Trinity. Okay. That's the individuality viewpoint. That's really our bottom-up viewpoint, exalted. Probably better to call it the individuality viewpoint than the bottom-up, but you can see it's that viewpoint. It's very approachable to us because, we're looking bottom-up. But to really flip around, truly flip around, maybe I should say, and see it from the unity viewpoint, okay? In that one, the Paradise Trinity doesn't come last. Paradise Trinity is really the first thought. You're kind of thinking about it, it's all together, and you're kind of thinking of it, it's the Paradise Trinity, but there's three parts in it that are individuatable. And so, you individuate them, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And the Trinity is what's left, the unindividuatable core essence of it. Okay? Okay, so now think about this from the father-mother viewpoint. See, from that individuality viewpoint, first you have the Father, and then eventually you end up with the Trinity, and now we know that the Trinity can give rise to the Mother. So the Father's first and the Mother's second. But from the unity viewpoint, the Mother's first and the Father's second.
Mother predates the Father?
Well, just conceptually, you're looking top down, you're seeing the Trinity is the first thing you're seeing, and the Mother comes directly from that. And then you have to penetrate down to see the Father. Or it's the other way around, individuality view. Well, of course, but that's one of the points we've been trying to make. Neither of them comes first or second. They're simultaneous, just like the Father and the Son and the Spirit are simultaneous, in truth. And see, this is a good example of how you can see the importance of truly getting the individuality and the unity viewpoint going together at once. Because in one way it seems like you have a first and a second, and the other way it's the other way around, and it's like, well, okay, oh, I bet it's not illogical. I bet it's, you know, I'm forcing it to follow a time-like character. Maybe it's actually in the infinite eternal ellipse and not a sequence.
They're co-equal.
Right, they're co-equal. I mean, you know, the reality is you've got the universal one of infinity and the infinite up there in that first level of total deity function, the static level, and you're just coming off of it simultaneously both directions, you know? And when you come off one direction, you give rise to the Father, and you come off the other direction, you give rise to the Mother simultaneously, okay? You know, but if you think about it, you know, if you break the ellipse into make it a line, and, you know, you start with the Father, and finally you end up with the Mother, it doesn't give the truth of it, okay? They're actually co-equal. So, this, see, you know, you only see are spurred onto this because, you know, you're needing to challenge yourself to go beyond your original viewpoint of things, which you now appreciate is very individuality viewpoint. It's so biased, if you will, really, to the Father. It's again, you know, that final sentence. When all is said and done, okay, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. Well, a human is an upward arrow. It's a bottom up. It's an individuality viewpoint. The Father is the highest concept in the individuality viewpoint. Okay, the adjuster is at the top and fundamentally can only look down. There is no up from there. Okay, there's only the unity viewpoint from the adjuster's viewpoint. You know, from that viewpoint, the first thing it sees is Mother, okay? You know, that's the unity viewpoint. Like you've heard me say so many times, it is the fundamental reason why the true nature of the Mother, God the Mother, has never been comprehended by humans. You know, the Mother notions that humans have had, that they've called deity, have been bottom-up and anthropomorphic. You know, exalted females, just like the Father has been an exalted male. You know, but we now know, well, okay, there's some validity because the Father is the culmination of the unity or the individuality viewpoint. But the Mother is not a parallel culmination of the individuality viewpoint. You know, the Mother is the root of the unity viewpoint. Yeah? The essence of the unity viewpoint. You know, all of these things. Like that, you know, especially but so easy to understand here, this compensation. You know? The Father divested himself, if you will, of the part that compensates for what he's about to do in making you an absolute individual. He didn't keep that part with him. He separated that part, and we call that part the God that remains in, the God of immanence. We call that God the Mother. Yeah. Yeah. If he's going to free himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity, like we said, there has to be God that remains in, the God of immanence, to compensate for the fact that he's going to step out. Okay? And he has to step out because there has to be an initiator, which is an outside in, an injection into space phenomenon. You know, but so he has to step outside, but that means something has to remain in, or there's nothing that upholds what he's about to inject into. Well, he's not going to inject into the vacuum.
If he didn't step out and he moved, everything would move. Nothing would move.
Right, and okay, there, exactly. Now think about that. The Paradise Trinity facilitates the Father's escape. See? Just exactly what you said. That's what that sentence means, what you just said.
So he can move out without everything following.
Right. If there wasn't a Mother, he couldn't get out. He couldn't escape because everything would follow him.
So that's the first relativity.
Yes. That's how fundamental the mother is to the picture.
He has relationship.
The upholder out
there. You know, and just, you know, if you're going to somehow think about the ellipse as being this picture of simultaneity, you know, if you start at one point and talk about something moving in one direction, there has to be an equal, you know, phenomenon. You know, father and mother, you know, and both of them reach all the way around. But, you know, you can understand what's going on is that they're reaching in opposite directions around the ellipse. You know, so that father and mother wrap all the way around the ellipse, and unity and individuality wrap all the way around the ellipse. Four things wrap all the way around.
It's like cosmic physics.
So she seems to get a freedom out of the deal too.
Right.
Chris, can you repeat four things?
Yeah, I mean, and just notice how ripe it is for a cliche joke about the difference between men and women. The man finally retires from his job. And now she's wishing, you know, that he would free himself from the fetters of unqualified staying at home-ness. Just think about how simplistically this gets expressed. It's that fundamental an aspect of reality that we could easily experience it in our day-to-day life, in our just kind of basic animal instinct, like reactions to each other. It's there.
Well, my wife will be working at home. She works in the home. Until I get home. Then her work stops. I didn't ever see her work. She only works when I'm not there.
And that's just what that first sentence of the Paradise Trinity paper is, just that. Not only can the father not work unless the mother stays in, the mother can't work if the father doesn't get out. This is the way it works. They're fundamentally transcendence and immanence. That's the two expressions of deity we're talking about. You know? And, you know, humans have been so confused about this. It's like, well, if it's transcendent, it can't be immanent. If it's immanent, it can't be transcendent. So I give up. It must be just magical. It's like, well, how about if it's transcendent and immanent? How about if deity is unity and individuality? How about if you have both the unity viewpoint and the individuality viewpoint, and you actually can achieve an understanding without resorting to magic?
Does God ever go fishing? Well, she'd get a lot done.
Probably the measure of truth to that is, you know, remember that sentence we read back in the previous paper about how you know, the mother influence dominates, you know, throughout the whole local universe ascension? I mean, pretty much there, the father front loads the phenomenon so much, you know, puts the adjuster in there right at the get-go. I mean, there's so much that he does in that opening initiation that he pretty much kind of goes fishing for a little while, because it's going to take so long for you and mom to get it all together after that. Okay.
I'm taking it from here. I'll be back later.
I'll be back when you catch your breath. Okay, anyway. So you can just see how fun this is. I mean, it kind of just brings a lot of the difference between man and woman alive when you can see it in this highest context. You know, the humility potential is so much greater. When you actually have the unity viewpoint to understand the difference between father and mother. Because not only have we gained the mother by achieving some true unity viewpoint, we've gained a much better perspective of the father. The father now is not just the universal father. The father is God the Father. And the God the Father has six aspects. First center, first source. Yes, universal father, but also universal creator, universal controller, and infinite upholder. Now there's room in the unity viewpoint for the whole picture of God the Father. And last time we started really talking about that facet that has been just really not comprehended at all with any real truth at all, and that's that universal creator facet. It's actually humans have flippantly used that term for a long time, But the specifics of that facet are actually pretty subtle. You've got to really start to get this, you know, separated out pretty clearly in your head before you can start to figure out where it fits in, especially when you know, you get a column that says sevenfold creators and you're thinking, well, that's got to be the first one in the list. It's not. It's the universal father. Okay, I'm really confused. You know, why isn't that the universal creator? It's a very, you know, the reality of infinity is subtle and complicated. You know, it's not simplistic. Okay, wait, there's one back here first.
Well, Chris, I just wanted to say somewhere else in the book, it talks about her being slow but effective.
Oh yeah, right. The you mean the quote that
Revelation fails to.
You know, that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution always will. Right. Yeah, that steady hand of the mother.
But she's effective.
Right.
And the father isn't always.
Right. Simply because it's such a subtle influence that it can sneak in between the cracks of your ignorant free will force fields. Not me, not going to do that to me. You know, you can, you know, the father is kind of really easy to spot and you can throw up a force field, you know, in a self-righteous way. But the mother's pretty sneaky, you know. She, you know, while you got your eye on the laser beam and keeping, you know, she's coming up from the bottom and just, you know, filling every crack and the next thing you know, it's all over. We progress in spite of ourselves because of the mother, see. You know, that subtleness that she has is very handy.
With the two of them together, I mean, they're kind of covered.
Right, tactics, right. Man, there's no escaping. No.
So, what did I say somewhere in the book, and I think it was the Jewish religion, where at the age of six, the mother gives over the child to the father.
Mm-hmm.
But, so there's a correlation with a child at six and finality at a six-stage spirit. So by the time we get to be six, you know, we'll be a six-stage spirit, yeah. And then the mother can pass.
Well, I mean, you know, bring it a little closer to home. You know, just think, you know, the mother's kind of handling, like we said, you know, all the way up to the local universe, and then she hands it off for the next spark. You know, you need a good, initiation. You know, and remember how it works, and it's when you finally get to Havona, then this whole bit of sort of doing it back and forth like this, it becomes simultaneous. You know, you're initiating and instantaneously, focalizing, you know, wrapping your mind around that initiation, you know, on a nonstop basis. You know, they're both just right there, boom, 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 in parallel, working with you. Because you have that perfect consecration of will at that point. So there's nothing blocking. And just, you know, noticing that when nothing is blocking, then they have complete access to you from both sides. You know, you're down here in the fifth domain on the other side of the ellipse here, okay? And there's complete engagement from both sides of the original. It's full-on father and mother all the way up through Havona. Okay, let's see. That's just part of the paragraph. Okay. All right, so, you know, you see the full context there. You know, you've got that reference to those threefold, that threefold functionality of the Trinity there. You've got the supreme, the ultimate, the absolute, the overarching of which is the mother, like we've talked about. But you also have, you know, noticing that we've got this ubiquity, that's the supreme. But when we're talking about the ultimate, that's transcendent, so that's an omnipresence. You know, and I mean, sometimes when they're talking about an absolute infinite, they'll also use omnipresence, because that's obviously transcendent of the finite as well. But here, just, you know, to make it nice and separated, they just said presence. But you'll talk, you know, you talk about the omnipresence of all three sources and centers. Yeah. So it's not like those terms are not applicable to the absolute phenomena, like in here, the absolute. But But they're obviously wanting to, you know, to get your first appreciation of the difference between ubiquity and omnipresence. Like the title of this paper, Time and Space, Supreme and Ultimate. They're trying to work on that contrast, you know, most definitively here. Okay, then that last little bit. Okay, why does it say this? Okay, it's not as strong as must, but we figured out why it says must, because that's this distinction is vital. You must figure out the mother thing, because it's key to the whole picture. Now he says, and you should remember that while deity ubiquity may be so often space associated, it is not necessarily time conditioned. Okay. Now this is so you don't get too simplistic in your thinking here. So often space associated. I mean, that's a basic way we're talking about the mother here, womb. We've got the local mother. There's the local universe is a womb. It's very much space associated, okay, and et cetera, the whole hierarchy of mothers, and you know, we're going up. But now if you talk about the absolute upholder, the absonite upholder is associated with the master universe, but the absolute upholder, the cosmos infinite is really all you can say at that point. I mean, okay, it's not really, so it's much space associated when you go all the way up to that level. But by and large, you can think of it in very space-associated terms. Like they said, it's spaceless, absolute presence in that mm-hmm. previous sentence. Okay, it is not necessarily time-conditioned. Okay, and this is, remember, that's our first thought when we've got this initial notion of father and mother that long before you discovered the fullness of God, the mother, like we have now, we knew about the Creator Son, the Creative Mother Spirit, and we've talked about that a long time. And she's very much time-conditioned. She's not conditioned by space, but she is by time. And the reciprocal for the Creator Son, he's conditioned by space, but not by time. Okay? We always talk about her as being time-conditioned. I mean, she's ubiquitous throughout the local universe at this time, and then the next time, and then the next time. But think about what we read just recently. When you go all the way up to the top level of direct ubiquity, the supreme level there, the finite upholder level, remember how they did that thing where they said, I guess if you look at it from the bottom up point of view, it's like the line between time and transcended time starts to blur. Remember how they're saying that? Okay. In other words, if you get all the way up to that level, it comes a point where maybe it's not quite time conditioned. Maybe that's, it's sort of this time and this time, not this time and then this time. And why is that? Because when you get up to that top level, like we pointed out back there, the more direct way to understand what's going on is the top-down view. Where you have God the Mother that's coming down, and you have downstepped expressions. When you get down to the supreme level, to think of that finite upholder as a downstepped expression of the absonite upholder rather than something that's welled up from the bottom, which is more directly what it is, then time conditioned, on the face that, that's pointing down into the finite, but the other face of it is engaged to the absonite. Okay, so see, the local universe mother is totally down immersed. She doesn't have one side that's on the that faces transcendence and one side that faces, the finite. It's finite on every side of her. But you get up to the top level, and there are two sides, kind of like the spirit of wisdom. It has subjective adjutant side, that's the energy of symmetry that's trying to engage the other six adjutants and get this symmetry set up. But the other side of the seventh adjutant, is what connects to the Holy Spirit, the objective side. So the seventh adjutant is subjective and objective, kind of the same way the supreme is time-conditioned and not time-conditioned. Okay, so that's That's what they're getting into. They're literally wanting you, see, to be able to really think about everything they're doing there. You've got to have this whole picture put together like we have now. You got to have all the hierarchy of mothers, including the stuff that goes beyond just this picture. You got to have the notion of the absolute upholder and the absolute upholder and all that, you know, all laid out to really kind of get what they're talking about here. That's the level at which they write this a paragraph like this. Just, you know, it's really amazing when you think about the way this book is written. You know, and so it's no wonder I can remember, you know, looking at this paragraph and going, okay, next paragraph. Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't know what the heck you don't know what to do with it. You know, and you know, you just see what we just did. It was like, well, no wonder I couldn't figure out what to do with it. I didn't have any of the tools in my toolbox to understand that paragraph in the way they want you to understand it. And so what you see is what they've done is just like they did back in Deity and Reality. It's here's a suggestion. Okay. You know, like you go, I don't know, this volitional with the Father, that reminds me of that thing when they're talking about him delegating. Where in the heck is that? And you dig around in the book and you, oh, it's in the Trinity. Why is it in the Trinity paper? Why is that delegation section in the Trinity paper? You know, and see, they're trying to point you, you know, and if you would just follow all these clues and put it together, eventually you'd figure it out.
So I can see back when they started in this book, the commission, the head guy of the commission saying, okay, you worked on it for 100 years, now we've got an encyclopedic view, that's good. Now we've got to get it down into 2,000 pages. The second phase of the right.
Yeah. And again, just the beauty of how all these, the composition by all these different authors is so, you know, coordinated, so unified. It's almost like there's an overarching mother-like influence that coordinates it all together.
Yeah. Well, that was the first thing I recognized about the book. I had a term for it at the time. I called it an organic quality to it that I recognized.
Yeah. See, now you know who that is.
Where that comes
That's
from.
Mom. Mom is the individuality of the whole. She's what gives this organic character to things. That's why, you know, they say what they say in that relative to kindred minds, you know. You know, like, this is astonishing the way these two minds are coordinated. It's almost like magic. No, it's almost like there's something that's connecting them. It overarcs them and connects them and coordinates them. It's the mother.
Don't panic, it's organic.
All right, let's read some more here. I mean, that first little paragraph, you know, is really the meat of it. The rest of it is kind of just secondary, you'll see. You know, once you've managed to understand the first paragraph, you know, the rest of it's like, okay, I get the rest of this. It's just kind of filling out the details a little bit. notice what they do here.
As mortal and Marantia ascenders, you progressively discern God through the ministry of God the Sevenfold. Through Havona, you discover God the Supreme. On Paradise, you find him as a person, and then as finaliters, you will presently attempt to know him as ultimate. Being finaliters, there would seem to be but one course to pursue after having attained the ultimate, and that would be to begin the quest of the absolute. No finaliter will be disturbed by the uncertainties of the attainment of the deity absolute, since at the end of the supreme and ultimate ascensions, he encountered God the Father. Such finaliters will no doubt believe that, even if they should be successful in finding God the absolute, they would only be discovering the same God, the Paradise Father, manifesting himself on more nearly infinite and universal levels. Undoubtedly, the attainment of God in absolute would reveal the primal ancestor of universes as well as the final father of personalities.
Okay, so it's a fun paragraph. What they're doing is they're giving you the individuality and unity viewpoints together, and showing how this functions together experientially. Notice, first of all, most of the paragraph is written in the context of that delegation. understanding. You start with everything all in the Father, and then he delegates out. So, it's talking about, the supreme and the ultimate and whatnot as being stuff, his stuff that he delegated out. So it's spoken of in that perspective. But the main reason for doing that is when you think about this, it's like, okay, so for instance, I go all the way up through the finite ascension, or they're calling it the supreme ascension, send up to the finite, to the point where I engage the supreme being. And like they said, what do I find in the supreme being? I find a supreme expression of the Father, of the universal Father. Okay. Well, where did that come from? Well, like we've been talking about, you take the finite mother and almighty, and you bring them together as one, and the she and the it come together and make the he. Well, notice how you kind of have a full circle here then, when you do it in this delegation viewpoint. So it starts out, you think of it as his, and he doles it out, then it becomes she and it, and then it evolves to the point where it's he again, and it's him. Well, of course it is, because in that understanding, he doled it out. Okay. But again, see, this is trying to take it up a notch again on he and she, thinking about he and she, and not thinking about it in simplistic anthropomorphic terms, but to think about it in unity viewpoint terms, deity terms. He is deity functioning as transcendence, and she is deity functioning as immanence. But all deity is one. That's the fundamental quality. Deity is unity. Okay? It's all one deity, but it has facets. And this is this distinction is vital. You must, not be confused, etc. To really begin to see the mother-father difference. Those two facets, and how they play together. Initially, it's all seeming like the father facet, and then it shifts over to the mother facet, and then it comes back to the father facet, then it goes back to the mother facet again as you go through the aptonite, the ultimate ascension, and then it goes back to the father facet. And so in just those big overarching experiential terms, as you think about your ascension career, you're kind of bouncing back and forth between which facet of deity is the most directly, just like in the local universe, the mother influence dominates. So that facet is mostly what's really there in front of you for a long time. And then the father facet comes, back up front. And then, okay. So the deity, because it's unity, it always is perfectly synchronized and coordinated like this and working together. Just when you need a little bit more initiator, you get more initiator. When you need, some good vocalization, guess what? There's a vocalizer. So it works coordinated like that. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so what next?
God the Supreme may not be a demonstration of the time-space omnipresence of deity, but he is literally a manifestation of divine ubiquity. Between the spiritual presence of the Creator and the material manifestations of creation, there exists a vast domain of the ubiquitous becoming, the universe emergence of evolutionary deity.
Again, we've basically talked about this, but just, they're putting it in the same context again. Notice the difference of deity and divinity. See how they've differentiated there? It's not appropriate to think of, and we talked about this, you can take this top-down view and, in a more direct terms, we talk about the mother and the almighty here down in the finite. But we pointed out that it's not like the power personality synthesis, the supreme, is only relevant when you get up to the absonite. It has some relevance down here in the finite, in space and time. But what are they saying? It's not a deity ubiquity. It's a divinity ubiquity, a divine ubiquity. For instance, one of those examples we talked about that's very extensively discussed is reflectivity. You know, you take the supreme mind that deity has, the supreme being, and the cosmic presence of that. You know, there's a divine ubiquity. You know, that's called universe reflectivity. Or if another way we talked about this divine ubiquity was that presence, that ubiquitous presence of the supreme can be thought of, you know, as, you know, no matter where you go in the finite, there you'll find a catalyst towards the synthesis. It's not a deity presence, but it is a divine presence. Okay, it's most directly the supreme. It's not really the mother or the almighty. It's the supreme. But because of that, it's not really deity. It's just divinity. Okay, and that's what they're pointing out here.
Right here we talked about these the spiritual presence, the creator, and then the material manifestations of creation. Just looking in this column, there's lots of ways you can think about that, but just look at this one column here, and we have these presences here that are tied to the creators, and down at the bottom we have the mechanical mind controllers, you know, directly created to the, connected to the things and everything, and in between we find the ubiquitous becoming, the domain of the ubiquitous becoming. We find the mother. The mother is the compensation. You know, mother is the totality attitude. She's the ubiquitous presence that allows there to be this separation between creator and creation. She fills that gap. It's another way to think about ubiquitousness, that is the mother. And so that really in her is that becoming. In her is the adapting, the progressing, the perfecting. Father initiates that, but it's in her that those verbs are.
And the becoming is also the domain of the universal absolute.
It's a mind womb.
Yeah.
Okay.
If God the Supreme ever assumes direct control of the universes of time and space, we are confident such a deity administration will function under the over-control of the ultimate. In such an event, God the ultimate would begin to become manifest to the universes of time as the transcendental, almighty, the omnipotent, exercising the over-control of super-time and transcended space concerning the administrative functions of the Almighty Supreme.
Okay, so now we can talk about that even more directly because we have the whole picture, but notice how they're trying to initiate the thought in a similar way they did. Let's see, that was back in the Universe Levels of Reality paper, I think. Do you remember how they said, well, when you think about the Supreme, then you think about the Ultimate, your first thought is, well, maybe the Ultimate is just sort of like an aggrandizement of the Supreme. You know, if I just take everything I know about the Supreme and I just take it up a notch, an exaltation of the Supreme. So if there's an Almighty, then there's an Omnipotent, you know, and then if there's a, you know, a finite upholder, there's an absolute upholder. And they said, well, you know, that gets you started. But see, back there again, they were more focused on like they are here, on the Almighty side. And that's the part where it's really simplistic to just think about going from, you know, as a simple two-node thing that you just take up a notch to the absonite. It doesn't really just go simplistically from an almighty to an omnipotent because the other 18 of the 20 triodities are coming into play and the other 8 of the triunities are coming. It's really complicated. It's not this simple linear thing, you know, like that anymore. But
even though there's a lot of limitation to doing the almighty to omnipotent thing, it is very direct to take the finite upholder and just lift that up to an absentite upholder. And that's what they're alluding to here. You know, God the ultimate would begin to manifest. We've already talked about that. God the ultimate begins to function as God the mother. There needs to be a womb in which all of these transcended beings like you and I and the supreme being, we're all in this new, bigger, absentite womb. You know, that's what they're talking about here. Okay, and that is a very direct thing. And why is it so? Why can you so directly just take that up to the next notch? Because it came down from the top in the first place. I mean, if anything, it's more definitively God the Mother on the absolute level than it is on the finite level. It's closer to the source. Okay, so it's all the more appropriate to take what you understand about the Mother here and just put it in the absentite domain, you know, as a bigger womb. But the Almighty, you know, you're getting farther away, you know, because that's welling up from the bottom. Okay? And so, not surprisingly, when you transcend that bottom up, you know, it may not just smoothly go across, and it doesn't. Then that's, you know, it's going to get a lot more complicated than that up there. But the mother is a constant because the mother is coming down from the top. She is the compensator for all of this difference. You know, even that difference of the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute, what arcs over the top of those three and compensates for even the differential between the three? The mother.
Earlier on, we were talking about that if, when point of view. And they start off here. Is that what you're referring to there?
That. Yeah. and again, it's it all seems very clear, but of course, even for the highest finite being, you know, we might be missing something. But you know that you're not missing the core fundamental essence because of what I just said. You're not really extrapolating. You're going the other direction. You're going back towards the source rather than away from the source. And so, you know, it's not so much a projection, see, from a source, away from the source. It's, you know. So you can be pretty confident, you know, in the truth of your thoughts about the mother throughout the whole picture. You know there's going to be some very universal truths that extend through that whole picture, that even you as a lowly finite being can latch onto.
It sort of makes sense if it's written by this particular thing, written by a mighty man. Wait a minute. Yeah. That he says if. But as we were saying before, the whole coordination of the book, in that respect, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense because there are beings who, you know, divine counselors and whatnot, who've already seen it from the other side.
Not divine counselors. No.
Well, who's the highest author here?
Yeah, none of them that have seen it from the other side. No master architects or authors, you know. Yeah.
Well, wasn't the divine counsel since I've been in the presence of the Father?
Yeah, but from bottom up.
He hasn't seen our end of it.
You know, he doesn't even have an adjuster to help him with the unity viewpoint, the top-down viewpoint. But here, the real specifics here.
That God the Supreme already exists. Right,
but see, the reason, there's a much more technical thing in play here. We're talking specifically about the administrative role of the Supreme here. Yeah. And he's being qualified there. I mean, obviously, the Supreme Being is going to be the center of the whole picture in the administration. But they're saying, well, but now, like, the master spirits don't have direct control necessarily. I mean, they put the Ancients of Days out directly in the, you know, or... Like with reflectivity, Magistan is in, you know, one of the directors. See, they know that as we get towards the grand universe being settled in light and life, there could be a whole bunch of beings that come into existence that are going to play very direct control roles in ways that they currently can't imagine. And so, you know, the fact that the word direct there is very important for the if.
He's indirectly in control.
You know he's going to be, yeah. I mean, always the first source and center of the indirect, at least the indirect control. So couldn't be anything else.
Is that a parallel to the father?
Yeah.
Divesting.
Yeah,
himself?
A little. Yeah, yeah. There again. That's another reason why they would.
To that point, right. Would be divesting himself.
Right. How much is there going to be stuff doled out? And of course, it can be. You know, there's another reason for looking at it top down from a bottom up viewpoint. How could he dole out anything? It's sort of everything has come together into him, but from a top down viewpoint, there's all this stuff. You know, that. Could be in addition to him, you know, that currently isn't, you know, recognizable from the bottom-up view of beings like a mighty messenger. You know, Magistan certainly wasn't, you know, recognizable from the bottom-up view. It's like, whoa, where did that come from? Totally out of the blue, see? You know, so there's these other things, you know, as you get closer to that boundary, all of a sudden things are going to come into view that weren't visible before. You know, they've been there on the boundary, but not visible to you because you have this very tunnel vision up to that boundary. You know, or not, maybe another way to think about it, it's, you know, remember how when we talked about the breadth and the depth and the length dimensions, and the breadth is insight? All of us have pretty circumscribed insight. We can only see into that. You know, so far and so broadly, and this the broad part. See, is really kind of directly in our analogy here. You know, the more we expand our insight, the more you can think of it as broadening. Like this, it's like, whoa, there's more than the supreme being there. There's even more than Magistan. There's a whole bunch of beings there that I didn't even know were there before.
I like how they.
He's got a comment too here. Just a second.
I just like how he said, you know, if God the Supreme, and then they didn't say such a deity administration would function, you know, it will function. You normally say if, then it would. You know, say will.
Right.
That's very common.
And that's title. I mean, he knows, you know, there's a lot of definitiveness to the ultimate. Imposing down, just like you're saying, you know, you can be pretty confident about this mother thread that you're bringing down and how that works. I mean, you started with the infinite upholder and you're bringing it down. You're not trying to extrapolate up to the infinite upholder. So it's the same thing here. It's pretty definitive that the ultimate has this over-controlling role. All the details, you know, are still fuzzy. But okay, you had one other thing too?
There's a question there, and you might be heading to.
Okay.
The parenthetical transcendent almighty.
Oh, yeah.
The omnipotent.
Right.
Kind of threw me there.
Right. It just again, you know, that the omni prefix, you know, signifies transcendence.
Yeah. And potent.
Yeah, mighty and potent, they're synonyms.
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, so it's just, omni, you know, is it.
Oh, I see.
That's why they connected.
You know, see, that's a, you know, but that's a good, you know, it isn't.
It's the right thing to know.
I was thinking of the Almighty as that aspect of
it. I mean, it does point out that you got a little bit of conflict of language here. I mean, but, you know, they want to use that term Almighty because that term that we've used for God. You know, throughout all of history, they want to put it in its appropriate place. It's like if you're going to call some part of the picture, some aspect of deity, the Almighty, don't call the Father the Almighty. Don't call whatever. I mean, call this facet of the Supreme the Almighty. Okay. Now, by all, we don't mean transcendent, but, So that's a little bit more. I'm trying to, you know, they said, you know, with. You know, the commission is to use all of our language as best they can without distorting the picture too much.
Well, they do. Now they're talking about the ultimate because it is transcendent, Almighty.
Yeah.
So it is
transcendent.
Right. But, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
The mortal mind may ask, even as we do, if the evolution of God the Supreme to administrative authority in the grand universe is attended by augmented manifestations of God the Ultimate, will a corresponding emergence of God the Ultimate in the postulated universes of outer space be attended by similar and enhanced revelations of God the Absolute? But we really do not know.
And of course, we've already done that. You know, that's what we've been doing. I mean, we talk about the absolute upholder. We've already started that speculation, and you know, and we're working with it. You know, knowing full well that there's, you know, almost an infinite number of things that we're that are not in in our picture. But you know, at least we got the beginnings of what we know has to be one thread of truth in the picture. And that's, I mean, that's another point to make. This whole, the more you can truly have a unity viewpoint, the more directly accessible truth is. And you can begin to get out of that fact finder, you know, fact, vision limited viewpoint. And you'll see they even, I hadn't thought about that, but they stress that in the next section here. So you know, the reason that we're making some fairly definitive statements about the Mother is that we're just speaking to the truth of God the Mother. I mean, knowing full well that we're pretty limited on the factual side of what the heck exactly we're talking about here, especially when we start talking about the, you know, Mother is absolute, you know, the absolute upholder, because like they're saying, it's, you know, you go to timeless, spaceless, and it's like, well, we use mother because it's womb, and well, and what does womb mean? I mean, it, you know, obviously the facts get a little bit hard to wrap your mind around, but you know the truth, you know, it has to be true that there's an absolute upholder, or the picture would just be illogical. I mean, it's obviously true. And then it's just a challenge to begin to try to put facts into relationship with that truth.
Chris? But there's only one word that's in italics. Is there something to remember by that? If I
I tried to stress that.
You did?
I mean, that's one of the key truths about the super universe level. It's not. It's, you know, it's not in contrast to Havona in simplistic thesis antithesis sense. It's not perfect and imperfect. Okay. Imperfect is not a fact. It's a lack of a fact. Okay, we live in an ing domain. We live in a becoming domain. Okay, there's the potential for adapting, progressing, perfecting, harmonizing. All those are facts of this domain. Those ings. It's a dynamic domain. It's in motion. And if you're going to strike step with it, you have to be doing. Man. Because it's all ing. You know, it's italicized because that's the character of the whole. And that's one of the basic characteristics of the whole. And this distinction is vital. Okay, if you want to be connected, you've got to be ing-like. You know, you've got to rise above, you know, the kind of doing, mere doingness of self that in and of itself just merges into the Almighty, the drop of water in the ocean. You got to establish real beingness, and then you got to build upon that foundation of true doingness, cosmic doingness, doingness that's tied to, you know, that's of a like nature to this italicized ing word here. You got to be becoming like it, the cosmos is. Okay? That's what makes you real. That's what gives you survival value. The Mother will uphold cosmic doingness. Okay? She doesn't, you know, eternally, well, yeah, well, it doesn't, let's flip it around. Eventually, she will stop upholding mere doingness of self. Okay? But she'll uphold the doingness, cosmic doingness, the doingness of personality, all the way up through the finite. You know, that's that You know, do you want to be upheld by the mother and eventually shake hands with the Supreme Being? Or do you want to just blend into the body of the Supreme Being and be that which I shake hands with? If you will. You can be the hand, but I'll be a person. You know, that's the choice you have. You know, you're just going to blend into the Almighty, or you're going to be there as an individual person, you know, and shaking the hand of that other person, the Supreme Being. You know? A person or an it?
I have one more.
Okay.
One of the modas.
Okay.
It's ask, do, with do. It's 21, the evolving soul is not made divine by what it does, but by what it strives to do. So,
right. And that,
my focus.
I see, and that's trying to challenge, you know, the when you say doing, the first thing that a self thinks is the doing of self, for and as the self, works righteousness. It's not made divine by works righteousness, okay? But if you can get above that doingness of self and get real beingness, then you'll discover that there's a whole other type of doingness that mankind has basically never even recognized, a doingness for the cosmos instead of for self. Mm-hmm. What happens if you go beyond the fifth level of meaning, if you go beyond selflessness? It's like, well, I guess I just go into nothing then. A drop of water in the ocean. No. No, you go to godlikeness. God the mother-likeness. Okay? You're upheld by that which is like her, a becoming. You know, are you a becoming or a going? Okay? A fading. Okay. One more thing, Kirby?
Yeah, well, the other analogy is constructive is that, you know, without us becoming, the Supreme does not become. The Mother does not get completed. Yeah. And so in the construction terminology, the image I like is that we're bridging. There's a bridging going on, a bridge being built, so that we can get across that bridge and do the handshaking you're talking about. Mm. There's a lot of giving and a lot of gifting. It's not all about the self. Once you have that that concept in mind, what can I do for God? The only thing you can do is cooperate and harmonize, whether it's God the Mother.
But and again, just to think about what you're doing in relationship to the Almighty and in relationship to the Mother. You know, the acts are ours, the consequences God's. You know, what you're just pointing to, you know, as you are, you know, truly do, the Almighty grows in parallel. So there's that linkage. You know, the Almighty is dependent upon you doing. Okay, think about the other dependence, though. If you aren't cosmic in character, she has nothing to hold. Okay, you know, that's your relationship with the Mother. she's there to hold, to uphold you, but she can only uphold that which has cosmic character, because that's the only thing that she feels, long term. You know? So you have two different relationships. You know, one, your growth is reflected in the growth of the Almighty. So there's this dependence there. But the other dependence is she needs someone to hold. So. She was made to hold, so God made someone for her to hold. You know, if you choose to be something that you can hold. All right, who wants to read the next one here? Before we go on forever. Reader. You want to read? You haven't read a long time, Michael. Okay, so we'll put it together a little bit, time and space.
Time, space, relationships. Only by ubiquity, good deity, unified time-space manifestations to the finite conception. For time is a succession of instants, while space is a system of associated points. You do, after all, perceive time by analysis and space by synthesis. You coordinate and associate these two dissimilar conceptions by the integrating insight of personality. Of all the animal world, only man possesses this time-space perceptibility. To an animal, motion has a meaning, but motion exhibits value only to a creature of personality status.
Okay. Let's just kind of put it in more common parlance here. So that first statement, only by ubiquity, could deity unify. Again, just thinking about it, if you have this system of associated points, and then you have this succession of instants. You know, if those two are going to come together, if you have something that has a hold of all the points simultaneously from one instant to the next, space and time are connected together. Okay, so that's kind of just a very straightforward statement when you think about it. And then that comment about time by analysis, space by synthesis. In other words, just like they said, because you think of this succession of events or succession of instants, there's parts. Analysis is about parts. Break it up into parts, you know, and go at each part and figure out how, you know, what it is and how they're connected. And okay, you know, so you dissemble it into parts to analyze it. Okay. Synthesis, in other words, the whole. So that they're contrasting the parts and the whole, and that relationship of the parts and the whole to time and space. Now, there's a parallel there. And what are they saying? Well, if there's any hope of being able to put a relationship with parts and a relationship with the whole together, there has to be something that transcends individuality and unity. Personality overarchs those two. It can step back and say, okay, so you coordinate, and you know, that coordinate and associate. It's like, well, okay, let's see, if I order them like this, and then I can associate them. Okay? Your personality can do that because it has an objective vantage point above both the parts and the whole. And then notice what they're doing there. You probably noticed that you were being set up for something there. Motion. They brought in the word motion. Okay. And the ing was an italicized word in the previous section. Okay. This paragraph is trying to get us to take a big step forward in our basic understanding of the physical universe. That it's not fundamentally a universe of things. It's a universe of motion. It's the opening paragraph. You know they're seeding everything that follows. So you want to hold on to what they put in that opening paragraph. Motion, motion. They mentioned it twice. Okay, so to an animal, motion has a meaning. But to a person, you can also recognize the value. You know, think about what they're pointing out. You know, we've this individuality, unity, and associativity, threefold actuality that we've talked about a lot. It's coming into play here, you know, because the first word of the next paragraph is things. Okay, we've got things, meanings, and values, and guess what? We're going to have fact, truth, and goodness. You know, they're going to be talking about this threefold actuality here. So get that picture in mind. And like we said, meaning. The way we basically understand meaning is the superadditive consequence of the relationship between things and values. Okay, or it's a flow from things to values or value to things. You know, it's this associative phenomenon between those two endpoints. Okay, for
an animal, notice they didn't say that there is no meaning. I mean, they're minded. But the animal has no ability to recognize the other endpoint. It can recognize things, but it has no ability to recognize values. It doesn't have the third cosmic intuition. Okay, and so, you know, that meaning that it's related to. I mean, there is value, but it's not within its vision. You know, it's connected to the mother, you know, local universe mother, is establishing this meaning, and they're just benefiting from the meaning in the meaning, you know, without any full recognition of the picture. But we can get the full objective picture. We can recognize the value that's attached on the other endpoint, you know, and really get a full recognition of the meaning of meaning, you know, and not just something that just you take for granted. And as we've pointed out that, you know, in that personality sense, because you're not an animal, you're not going to feel satiated by just the mere meaning that you get as a gift of grace to be minded by that which has value. Okay? The meaning that is going to satisfy you is the meaning that comes from you grabbing a hold of value as well as a hold of thing. And then and only then will you find the meaning that satisfies you inside. Okay? Because you're a person, you have to grab a hold of anything. You know, an animal doesn't feel empty because it doesn't have a hold of value. It just goes along matter-of-factly. Okay? And the meaning that is there by grace.
Boy, that's it.
Doesn't the value for the animal imply survival?
No. Because it, just like it doesn't merely apply survival for you and I, you know, you can be morally good, loyal, filial, even idealistic. But if there's no personality grasp of that, it has no survival value. Just the mere, you know, recognition of meaning, standing there in front of the great vista. Of value, the great vista of value, and going, ooh, isn't it wonderful and beautiful and, you know, and good? Well, but it's not yours. You haven't grabbed a hold of it. You're a drop of water in the ocean, okay, until you grab a hold of it, okay? Like I was just saying here, you have to give your life true meaning. You have to actually grasp. You're not only given through the third cosmic intuition, that spiritual insight, the ability to recognize value, but you're given personality to function through that third cosmic intuition. You're given faith, grasp. You can actually grab a hold of that which you see, and you must. Because until you do, you haven't realized. Remember the levels of meaning when Jesus is talking about the fear of the Lord? If you start out with fear and you move up through anguish and dread, mm-hmm. and awe and reverence, and maybe you take that next little step and you actually recognize the level of recognition on the third level of meaning. Okay, but if all you have is just a source for greater reverence, if you just stand there at that level of being. And be that which is reverent for what it sees. There's no survival value. You have to take that next step up. Above the level of recognition is the level of realization. You have to realize it within you. Not just recognize it afar off. You know, no matter how reverent you are of it, no matter how much you recognize its beauty in it, you know, and it makes you weak in the knees, no survival value. You have to grasp it. You know, that, you know, and because humans...
Just be overcome by
it. Humans use recognition and realization as synonyms all the time. Think about it.
Yeah.
It's because it's sad to record.
Right.
Okay? The very fact that we tend to use those two words as synonyms, flippantly, as interchangeable, shows you how little we've gone beyond just mere recognition. Actually realized. I mean, thank goodness for Pentecost. Okay? That allows even the faintest little bits, to actually be made substance. Okay? There's some realization. Remember they call the adjuster the realityizer?
Yeah.
Okay? You get some realityizing happening here in a very unconscious mode.
Right.
Okay? You don't have to get up to that level of consciousness of a third circler now. To truly realize.
So that's where you get behind the wheel and actually hit the gas. You're actually
right.
Doing something. The action starts to take place.
Recognition, realization, appreciation, love. Okay? Again, the fact that we don't even really differentiate between recognition and realization. So how much does it pain them to use the word love, which is way up above there still? We all have to be humble about this, and there's a big journey here that we need to challenge ourselves to take. Okay, so the motion and the meaning and the value. Let's take it to the next notch here.
Things are time conditioned, but truth is timeless. The more truth you know, the more truth you are. The more of the past you can understand and of the future you can comprehend.
Okay, just a little seed for the next paragraph. It fleshes it out more in the next paragraph. But truth is timeless. Okay, that's the eternity viewpoint. I take it. They're taking a full top-down truth viewpoint here. And this is something we haven't really done much. Because we've been working on this, where we have fact, truth, goodness. And just like with meaning, we say, well, there's fact on one end, goodness on the other end, and the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two is truth. Okay, that's an individuality viewpoint, understanding. And it's true, but it's limited. It's just an individuality viewpoint of it. What they're doing here is they're challenging you in the context of having this unity viewpoint to discover the mother and everything. Coincidentally, they say, now that we've got you in the unity viewpoint, think about truth in that top-down viewpoint, in a technical way that you've never done before, where you're starting with just truth in and of itself, not truth being the super additive consequence of two pre-existent things. Just like we didn't think about the Trinity as the super additive consequence of three pre-existent things. We just thought about the Trinity first. Mm-hmm. And the three things second. We're doing the same thing here with truth. A top-down viewpoint. Okay, so in that viewpoint, truth just is. The truth is timeless. And you're bringing it into your beingness, so you are. That if that relationship with the infinite eternal ellipse, that realization brings that timeless truth into your beingness. Okay. Very top-down viewpoint of yourself. Okay?
Truth is inconcussable.
Unshakable, in other words.
Forever exempt from all transient vicissitudes, albeit never dead and formal, always vibrant and adaptable, radiantly alive. But when truth becomes linked with fact, then both time and space condition its meanings and correlate its values. Such realities of truth, wedded to fact, become concepts and are accordingly relegated to the domain of relative cosmic realities.
Okay. So they're linking the two viewpoints together here. They're bringing this eternal truth down and relating it to what we understand from the bottom up, the individuality viewpoint about truth. Because we know if we're going to bring it all the way down, where does fact and goodness fit into the picture? Because it's fact, truth, goodness. You know, and we're just talking about the actuality here. We're not talking about beauty, you know, truth, goodness. And you're going, well, you know, it seems to me like I want the eternal truth. I don't want this thing that has the word relative attached to it and relegated. And oh, but look at the second word of that last sentence. Such realities of truth. Okay. You are not an existential being. You can't realityize just truth in and of itself. How many times have they made this point, you know, recently that you have to use your personality to grab a hold of all three facets of the threefold actuality, you know, and create a harmony. That's what makes you real. You are real as a patterned, a purposed threefold actuality. That's what makes you real. But you can be motivated in this work of getting a hold, you know, like I said, getting all the things and getting all the values so that you can have true meaning, getting a hold of fact, facing facts, adjusting them to ideals, getting a hold of those two endpoints, you know, and establishing that truth. You can be more motivated by that, recognizing that what you're doing is, the reason you're wanting to do that is not because you want to imagine that you're a creator being, and because you grab a hold of these two things magically, the super additive consequence comes into existence. What are you really doing there? What you're doing is, by getting a hold of them both, you're identifying with something that you can see is coming down from above. You're identifying with the eternal and the infinite. You're wrapping yourself around the infinite eternal ellipse. So seeing why you do this individuality effort, why go through the effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, progress, slog, okay? Why go through all of that? It's because you want to get your bottom-up nature, that upward arrow that's called a human, you want to get that to meet what's coming down. And they do meet. The eternal truth, it's just truth in and of itself, does meet with the truth that's the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two endpoints.
Chris, would that truth also meet at some person who's at that fear level of God? To them, that's truth, even though it's very, very low. And yet it's inconcussable, exempt from all transient vicissitudes. And that's God's mercy showing in a way that even though you're way down there, you still recognize truth and can go up.
Right. I mean, primarily because you know that the eternal sees you with eternal eyes, not with temporal eyes. And, you know, the Father views that individual who is trying their best, you know, as already there with him in eternity. You know, so the engagement from above, you know, is absolute. It's not relative. But we're relative. See, and that's the point they're trying to make. The truth that's coming down from above is not relative. But our engagement of it is always relative. Because in order to engage the truth, we have to do it in this threefold fashion. We can't just be the truth and ignore the facts and the goodness. We have to bring the three together. Okay.
Where the rubber meets the
road. Yeah. And that perforce means it's going to, where did they say that? Time and space condition its meanings and correlate its values. It has to. Yeah.
Well, they're also pointing to the mechanism how that works by using the word concept, because you got facts, which is on the things end, and you got truth, which is obviously on the values end, because it just defines
concepts are in the mind.
And it comes together in concepts, which is a mind feature,
right.
And we've got the gift of the mind, which of course we wouldn't be able to do any of this if we didn't have all these gifts. And this is one of the biggest ones.
Mm-hmm.
God's not going to say, be perfect, without giving you the mechanisms with which to do that.
How do you get, you know, remember that statement about getting to God by spiritualized thinking? Again, seeing the, you know, not so fixating on the spirit end, but the mind is very important in the picture. Yeah.
as this might sound detracting, it shouldn't be, but my thinking of my Bible-believing self, I think, you know, that truth that we're speaking of is they will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. Mm-hmm. And I thought about the word in spirit. In truth,
mm-hmm.
And that's mother-like, right?
Well, it's just something.
It's not all ambiguous, yeah. Right? Is immersed, so that's in instead of on.
Right. Just go back and think about look at these three lines here. You know, it doesn't just say beauty, truth, and goodness. I very purposely made them those phrases, and the preposition in this endpoint phrase is of. And this endpoint phrase is of, but in the middle it's in. Belief, it's belief in truth, but it's admiration of beauty and reverence of goodness. Why? Because where is your consciousness? It's here in the middle. Right. You're in the truth.
Yeah.
Your consciousness is in the truth. But you're looking to the endpoints, okay? Yeah, there's the reverence of the beauty, and there's the reverence of the goodness, but you're in the truth. And you know, it's the same reason why, like I pointed out. I mean, why when we say those three, don't we say beauty, truth, goodness? Why don't we say them in this structural order? Why do we say truth, beauty, goodness? Because that's the experiential order. You're in the truth. That's what you see first, you know, in your material identity. So where do you go next? You know, the next immediate thing is the beauty on the individuality end. And then thirdly, you bring in the goodness. That's the experiential order. That's why we say truth, beauty, goodness. All right, so, and then one more little thing to bring in this top-down view.
The linking of the absolute and eternal truth of the Creator with the factual experience of the finite and temporal creature eventuates a new and emerging value of the Supreme. The concept of the Supreme is essential to the coordination of the divine and unchanging overworld with the finite and ever-changing underworld.
All right. So look at this neat new way of thinking about truth. That fact, truth, goodness, threefold when you come at it top down. So you have the truth coming down, and then it engages fact, and then brings into existence goodness. Okay. You know, and actually putting that in a whole cosmological context, even not just a, you know, sort of an individual or, you know, sort of conceptual context, but, you know, literally the creators, yeah, you got all the creators, and then the finite and temporal creature, you know, the factual experiences, see, so you have the truth of the Creator and the facts of the creature. Bring those two in a relationship and give rise to the, you know, the value or the goodness of the Supreme. So to see the Supreme as coming into existence, you know, in this top-down viewpoint, you have to have the Supreme in order to get the full threefold actuality in the cosmos. So you can see the unity endpoint here. Like they're saying, so that you have a divine and unchanging overworld, you have a compensation, remember that compensate, you have a compensation for the individuality, the individualized facts, right, that's an overworld relative to that you know, the ever-changing individuality facts of the under in the underworld. So it's just they just took this opportunity to give you a whole other way of thinking about the threefold actuality and even the Supreme and your relationship to the Supreme. And you're going, wow, I'm really glad I have the Supreme so that I have a touchstone that's divine and unchanging. And of course, what are you directly touching? It's not the Supreme as the Almighty, or even the Supreme as the Supreme. It's the Supreme as the Mother. That's experiential touchstone. The cosmic over control, the coordinating, the coordinate action, et cetera, the totality attitude, the Mother. Yeah, that divine and unchanging overworld.
Okay. I think that's a new word.
Overworld is a once word in the book.
Chances it's in the dictionary.
I suspect it is. But
look at the middle that we're meeting in. We actually use eventuate.
Remember in the old cosmologies, you always had, and we still talk about the underworld. Uh-huh. Well, recognize they always had an overworld too in those cosmologies. That was the whole point. You lived on the plane. And there was the heaven, the overworld, and then the underworld.
And they were relatively unchanging, the heavens. Right. That's where astrology came.
All right. Let's do some more here. We've got a little bit of journey to go yet here. Right. A little bit of physics yet.
Space comes the nearest of all non-absolute things to being absolute. Space is apparently absolutely ultimate. Mm-hmm. The real difficulty we have in understanding space on the material level is due to the fact that while material bodies exist in space, space also exists in these same material bodies. While there is much about space that is absolute, that does not mean that space is absolute.
Okay. I don't want to go too deep into the weeds here on this right now, but the basic thing they're doing is they're bringing in, they want you to be puzzled by this and search around in this section for some clue and finally think, well, I wonder if there's something in the first paragraph that might be a clue. Well, they use the word motion twice in the first paragraph. I wonder if that's a clue. Okay, that's what they're doing here. This is the new physics that they're beginning to lay out. We talked about this a little bit, and we talked about total deity. When you're coming down in perspective, basically the unity viewpoint gives you space and motion. Right, we talked about that. It doesn't so much give you, the unity viewpoint doesn't really give you space and time. It gives you space and motion. The individuality viewpoint gives you space and time, with a little caveat. And they're referring to that here. If you think about kind of coming down and having space as some sort of a container, because it's, like they said, it's absolutely ultimate. So in other words, you can think of it as being transcendent of everything. Okay, so it's a outer, reaches of transcendence. Okay, so anything you're contemplating, it's always transcendent of that. So it's a container in which things are happening. You have that's called extension space. It's just there's this extent in which things are happening. And there's motion in that, like pervaded space. There's motion that fills that space. Okay. You drop down a notch, and the individuality viewpoint comes into play. And you don't necessarily think of that motion in direct unified terms. You think about it in abstract terms. A space part and a time part. Okay. For instance, when you talk about motion, you talk about like speed, like miles per hour, a space unit over a time unit. You think of motion, you abstract it as a reciprocal relationship between space and time. Okay? And so down in that
down in that individuality viewpoint, you now have this thing you call time, which is this chronicity of the motion, the ongoingness of the motion. Okay. But there's another part. There's not just the chronicity of the motion. What about that spatial part? What about the spatiality of that motion? And that's what they're referring to here. The real difficulty we have in understanding space on the material level, you know, down there at the individuality viewpoint, remember matter, that's the individuality, okay, getting it down to the individuality viewpoint, is due to the fact that while material bodies exist in space, that extension space that we kind of conceived of basically when we were kind of up in the absentite and before we really got down into the finite to think about things like space and time, like we do, so not only do the bodies exist in that extension space, but space also exists in these same material bodies. If you think of them as what they really are, as a motion, which you can abstract as having a spatial part and a temporal part in reciprocal relation. Okay, so this is what they're saying. See, so you have a space part that I've already kind of suggested it. See, that's really more finite-like. The space is actually a property of the motion of the thing that you're talking about. Yeah. And then you have the transcendent space, really the more absentite backdrop that motion exists in. So you have two spaces.
Now you're getting into the weeds. Okay.
See? That's what they're pointing to here. See, while there is much about space that is absolute, okay, that extension space thing that they're talking about, you know, thinking of it as absolutely ultimate, that's what you're referring to there. I mean, it's transcended to everything. See, I mean, so technically you can think of it as an absolute. Even though for working purposes, you can think of it as an absolute. But that does not mean that space is absolute. And then this is just reminded me, once you recognize it's a universe of motion and there's a spatiality and a chronicity to that motion, well, it's like, well, that spatiality of that electron, you know, is not absolute. I know I can't think of that as absolute.
You were just a little bit earlier, you described it. I brought up an image in my mind of you said there was space and this substance, what did you call it? The material? Because the space is actually inside the material. But you described it more of a dance, it seemed like.
Oh, reciprocal? Mm-hmm. When I was talking about
There's
extension space?
There's extension space, right. And there's the other space they're talking about. I just don't know what word you're using.
Materially coupled space.
Well, here, look at the next paragraph. Let's read the next paragraph, and then we'll talk about it a little bit more.
It may help, John. Okay.
Yeah, there is a reason I want to read the next paragraph, because it's going to help me here. And it may help.
To an understanding of space relationships, if you would conjecture that, relatively speaking, space is, after all, a property of all material bodies. Hence, when a body moves through space, it also takes all its properties with it, even the space which is in and of such a moving body.
Okay, so that's the way they see. That's why there's what they're suggesting for an initial way to talk about what you're thinking of there. See, mm-hmm. I mean, it's what I'm saying. I mean, it's a universe of motion. Everything is a motion. If you're talking about a particle, it's a motion. Okay, and what they're saying is, you know, you've already got notions of thinking about, well, that particle may have a mass and a charge, and it takes those properties along with it as it moves through space. Well, take it to the next notch. Take it to a truer physics. Because if it's a motion and not a thing, it doesn't just take these things that you think of as thing properties, like mass and charge, along with it. Okay, it is a motion. And so, you know, that's why you have, you know, those Newton's laws of motion. Okay, It is this motion, and the most direct way to understand what it is as a motion is it has a spatial part and a temporal part. That space is a property of it, like mass and charge. It has this property of it. Yeah.
It's its
Well,
I mean, that encapsulates everything.
Well, let's see. I don't want to go too deep in the weeds here. They're just trying to point out that when you go to think about the true nature of an object, a better physics, there is an extension aspect of it that is inherent in it. It has a radius, if you will. It has a finite footprint because of what it is. It's not in the simple way of where you say, well, the solar system has a finite footprint because there's a sun in the middle and there's planets go around, and so like there's this region, this radius that the planets orbit within. Not like that. Not in the sense of it has a nucleus and electrons that go around it, and so there's kind of a space in which all those billiard balls are rattling around. What they're trying to get you to understand is that it's not a billiard ball universe. It's not a universe of things. It's a universe of motion. And so fundamentally, if you take an individuality of motion, it just has a dimensionality to it because of that fact. Because your first understanding of it as a motion is that there's an extent part and a chronicity part. Okay? And it's because of that that an automaton has a radius. It's not because it's a billiard ball. It's because it's a motion, it's an individuation of motion of a certain magnitude. The more motion it is, the bigger its radius. Not the bigger the billiard ball, the bigger the radius. There is no billiard balls. Everything's a motion. Mass is a motion. Charge is a motion. Everything's a motion. Okay? But motion has a spatial character, and that's why there's some validity to thinking about it's a universe of things. It's a universe of billiard balls. See, but what it really is, you know, you're saying that the spatial part that you experience just fundamentally is what it is. It's like, no, it's only part of what it is. That's the numerator of what it is. There's also a denominator of what it is. Okay? And you don't recognize that yet. And that's why your physics is so messed up. Okay?
It's a motion. It's a tight motion that follows a pattern.
Yeah, we do. Like I said, we don't want to go too deep in the weeds.
All right.
Because this gets, you know, we don't want to read. We could redo a lot of fundamental physics right now, but we're not going to do that right now. But anyway. This is what they're referring to.
It should tease us, though.
Yeah, this is a teaser.
All right. All patterns of reality occupy space on the material levels, but spirit patterns only exist in relation to space. They do not occupy or displace space. Neither do they contain it. But to us, the master riddle of space pertains to the patterns of an idea. When we enter the mind domain, we encounter many a puzzle. Does the pattern, the reality of an idea, occupy space? We really do not know, albeit we are sure that an idea pattern does not contain space. But it would be hardly safe. It would hardly be safe to postulate that the immaterial is always non-spatial.
Wow. Okay, there's some pretty heavy-duty things there. But let me just give you a little hint of it. I know it's getting late, but let me just give you a little hint of that, so that it isn't just a meaningless paragraph. Remember, we've talked about in a simple finite viewpoint, we have energy pattern and spirit pattern. And they're alluding to those two different types of pattern here, okay? You know, and of course, not just abstractly the pattern, but the pattern imposed upon an actuality so that you have a reality. You know, and we're talking about patterned material actualities. They have this very definitive relationship to space, okay? They occupy space. Okay? But those, when you pattern spirit substance, you have something that has a relationship to space, but you shouldn't think of it as occupying space. After all, it's the unity substance, and so, you know,
not the individuality substance. So that, you know, immediately it should kind of push you away from thinking too simplistically about it. This is something we've never really talked about, because it in the finite domain, you just have those two. In the first seven triunities, you just have the energy pattern triunity and the spirit pattern triunity. But when you go to the other eight triunities, when you bring in the absonite, there's another pattern triunity, the absonite pattern triunity. And that's not just about then. The absonite is also now. And the absonite has a lot to do with bringing the two endpoints together, like mind does. There is the absonite pattern triunity, which is, you know, most directly an absonite thing. They're pointing out that, you know, a lot to do with mind is like the absonite. It's why they encounter many a puzzle. Because it really has a measure of transcendence in it. Just think about it. You know, just like we always do here. This related to this gives rise to a super additive consequence, a transcendent fact. Well, finite and finite, you know, yeah, we think about this as finite, but see, you're creating a transcendent finite in that viewpoint. And so it's going to be a little bit more absonite than the two things you started with.
I mean, they even say eventuate. As our contribution.
Yeah. So this is what they're suggesting you to think about, is that, you know, you can begin to talk about the purposing directly of the mind, not just the purposing that comes as a consequence of the purposing of the individuality and the unity, but a purposing that's more directly related to that super additive consequence and the pattern of an idea. In other words, the relationship of what you're doing, even as a finite being, to the absonite. Mm-hmm. And how confusing this is when you start talking about space. Wow. Because you're bringing in the whole transcended space.
Absolutely thing. Ultimate.
Okay? Just one other little parting thing. You can spend a lot of time reflecting on this some more. This time-space, just to kind of sum that up a little bit, that in that relationship to supreme and ultimate, and supreme ultimate, the supreme, you know, is definitely the over-controller of our evolution, a very, you know, when you think of evolution, you think of time. I mean, your most immediate thinking about your relationship with the supreme is in this temporal sense. But but just like space is transcendent, even to the point of being absolutely ultimate, the ultimate is transcendent. And so it's much more of the backdrop for the, you know, the drama of time. Okay? And like the ultimate is the backdrop for the supreme. But these two work together even now. Even when you start to, if you're going to really talk about fundamental physics, fundamentally particles are absonite phenomena that have a finite footprint. Okay? And you are too. And like they're pointing out at the end here, your mind is a good example of, to really understand mind, you've got to start having a quasi-absonite sort of a thing in play, because you have mindal wombs. You know, you have this mind that's ubiquitous. Only by ubiquity could deity unify time-space manifestation. See, that mindal womb has some supreme ultimate character to it. And maybe for no other reason, she's the creative mother spirit. There's mother deity in her, and that mother deity came down from above. Just like particles are really expressions that come down from above. They're absonite first and finite second. Okay?
So what we are becoming already has an reality to it or an actuality to it?
Yeah. I mean, right. I mean, it's...
That's a question.
Though. Well, again, it's just another way that you can begin to see that if I'm really going to be able to think about stuff, I can't just take a temporal viewpoint. I need to take a bottom-up and a top-down viewpoint. I need to think about things more in this infinite eternal ellipse viewpoint where I think about it all together as one. Even if I'm going to think about exactly how space and time and physics works, yeah. You've got to do this.
Which, okay. By the way, has more becomingness to it.
Okay. So you've always got to challenge your mind to outside the box, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to get into a process theology thing, you know, following being dedicated to the process.
Asymmetrical, too much and, bottom up.
And it just closes in. It gets smaller and smaller and instead of bigger and
bigger. And what's the key for really going outside of the box? Use that which came from outside of the box. It's imprisoned in the box right now, but it came from outside of the box. Use that fragment of the infinite upholder. Use that adjuster to catalyze this top-down viewpoint. You know? Not only are you going to have this distinction as vital and the recognition of the mother and all those issues about the brotherhood of man, for instance, but you're actually going to be able to think about the true physics. You're going to be able to think about an automaton and an electron the way they truly are. Absonite first and finite second. And how that changes everything. Where right now it's finite first and nothing but magic second. Okay.
That's about the size of it.
Well, I mean, it's literally the size of it. That's exactly, obviously if you put the tip of the iceberg, first, and say there is no part below the water, the thing that pokes above the water and does things, it behaves magically. Right. For instance, you go up and you hit it, it looks like this tiny little ice cube floating on the surface, and you think, I'm going to smack that thing and hit it across the surface of the water. What happens when you hit it? You break your fingers, okay?
It magically pushes back,
okay? Okay? That's the current physics, magic physics, because we think that it's finite only, You don't even use the word first. It's finite only.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But... But it's, see, again, so the mother transforms physics, too. Okay? Thinking in terms of the mother transforms physics. All right. they don't let up. They keep going. But that's for a week from now.
we have to stop sometime.
All right. So
that was great.
We'll pick up. We'll pick up next time and try rattling around some of these things in your head. Go back and read this again and see if you can think some of that through yourself. And so it won't be quite as difficult to keep going because you know everyone knows there's a lot more yet to come in this paper. So spend a little time this week seeing if what did Chris say about that. See if you can. You can cycle that through yourself. All right, let's take a moment here.